It's the 8th of May 2023, heading into Lag BaOmer. Someone texted me privately that he has to sign off because he's going to a wedding. So a little late, but that's the Lag BaOmer. So you can't start in the middle of the day. I just want to call your attention to this book that appeared. Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. That's the picture we all know. This is the translation of the Yiddish volume that came out 2 years ago. It's sponsored actually by someone who listens to us most weeks, or if not every week. So anyone who's interested in this, in Zionism, in the Rav's early lectures, you want to look at this. The first lecture is actually from 1939. And now I understand why. In the Mizrahi magazine, they said, beginning in the late 1930s and continuing for several decades, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik delivered the keynote address at the Convention of Mizrahi. And I said that it's not true. He wasn't a member of Mizrahi. So I know where they got it from, because in 1939, he did deliver an address at Mizrahi, but it wasn't the keynote, and he wasn't even a member of Mizrahi. It's interesting that the Rav, at the same time that he's an Agudist, he also appears at the Mizrahi convention. And now I'm starting to think, maybe all this discussion of the Rav as an Agudist, again, he's listed on the Presidium of Aguda and the Central Executive Committee, one of the Moetzes Chachmei HaTorah. I don't know how far we should take this, because I was reading Fishman's English introduction, which somehow I missed in the Yiddish volume. I only read the Yiddish. I didn't read the English. I didn't even see it. In the English introduction, he points out, and this is new, no one knew about this, that as early as 1940, June, he is a member of the Mizrahi Committee to Strengthen Torah, which consists of more than 40 rabbis, and he's writing appeals for Mizrahi. So he is a member of both Mizrahi and Aguda. So, I mean, was he a Mizrahi? Was he Aguda? It seems that he just felt that both organizations were valuable, and he joined both organizations. I see Fishman also points out that the first lecture in 39 has no real Zionist or religious Zionist character. It's simply a drusha, and it wasn't even on the official program. So it's definitely not a Mizrahi. He's not identified with Mizrahi then. I was in YU this week, and I was in the office of the honors program, and I saw a picture. I'll show you now. I then found on a YU website. From the same visit of Belkin to YU, and there's no question that Ben Gurion's. I was wondering if maybe they, someone drew in his kippah, Photoshop. But here it's obvious. Now, why Ben Gurion? The only pictures I know of him with a kippah, maybe he forgot his hat and he couldn't be at YU. So this is Ben Gurion from that same visit you clearly see he's wearing a yarmulke. If any of you know of any other pictures of Ben-Gurion wearing a yarmulke, I don't know of any. So that's, I think, worth noting. Incidentally, while I was at YU, I spoke to one of the Rosh Yeshiva on the fifth floor of Gottesman. If with all his books, he's always there. And I mentioned to him the issue that we spoke about earlier about Muchsak B'Kashrus, and I'm happy to say that he said exactly what I said, that a Muchsak B'Kashrus doesn't need a Hashgacha. That's the halacha. And he said his uncle had a store in Borough Park. I think he said a candy store. No Hashgacha, everyone ate there. So I thought that was of note, coming from, he's a Posek also. For those who wanted to know about this, the tshuva, I said, of Eretz Chemda, of driving, having a non-Jew bring you to shul on Shabbos and Yom Tov. This is found in B'Mara HaBazak on volume 3, page 38. The argument is basically, it's a, I thought that it was considered a Darabana. No, it's a Daraisa driving in the car, but it's a, for the non-Jew, it's a Torah prohibition. That is, there's fire going on. So it's, but for you going in, it's Darabana. And Already the Ramah says mutar amira nachri b'shabbos b'malacha b'mkom mitzvah, so that you can have a non-Jew do something for you with a malacha when it's a mitzvah. So that's where they base it on, but they say that it shouldn't be every week. This is not the same as, for example, I hear that in Deerfield now, in Florida, they have like a, there's a bus that goes around the community, and the rabbi is given permission for people to just get on it and be dropped off at the shul because they can't walk, it's too far. That is not, that's no different than, like in Boston going on the T, or even, I guess going on the subway. Many rabbanim permitted this, years ago. That's not what the situation was going to be. I think it was maybe in Century Village, they wanted a Shabbos bus that is just for the Jews. That's where Rabbi Jack Simcha Cohen wrote about this, and this was not accepted. That I think Rav Schechter was very opposed to it, but supposedly he supports this one because if it doesn't go specifically for you, I think the case that Rabbi Jack Simcha Cohen was dealing with was not just that people were too old, they couldn't get the shul, but there were people who were driving. So this was a way, maybe he was in West Palm Beach, not where he was a rabbi, not not Century Village. And also the Rav, since you're dealing with the Rav, I'll mention that when the Rav, when Rabbi Rakefet was in Moscow, and he saw that they had one synagogue there, the Choral Synagogue, and how were the Jews supposed to get there? They're living all over the city. So he wondered if perhaps in those days you could buy a pass, like a monthly pass, you could sew it into your garment, and then you could go on the subway every day, and that would solve the problem. The subway is not stopping for you, it's just stopping for everyone. I mean, this question is going back a long time. Even in Venice, they dealt with this. Can you go on the gondolas that don't stop for you, but just stop? It was like a bus service. In India, they had this issue as well. The rabbis actually gave permission in India. So when Rakefet comes back from Russia, he calls the Rav. And the Rav says, absolutely not. We cannot matter this, even if the people can't get the shul. He said that once the conservatives have permitted driving the shul on Shabbos, that we have to be very strict on this and we can't compromise. Two more things. One more thing, and then I'm going to deal with the other Rosh Yeshiva that we spoke about last class. Thank you, James. A few classes ago, I mentioned how in the Rav's minyan, to this day, the Maimonides minyan in Kaddish, they omit v'isala. That is, v'isparach, v'ishtach, v'ispar, v'ishramah, v'isaseh, v'isadar, v'isalev, v'isalev. Just stop right there. V'isaleh or v'isalal? I think, I forget now which one. I thought it was Visalal they omit. They omit one of them. I have to look again. So they don't have eight. They have seven. And I wondered, are there any other shuls that do this? I said, maybe there's a Minhag Agrah in Israel. And he points out that today in Brooklyn, I guess it's in Brooklyn. He says the Grub Minyan. I don't know whether if that's Flatbush or Borough Park, omits the word. And then he mentions that they follow similar Grub Minhagim. Which after I read this, thank you, James, for sending it to me. It reminded me of something. I don't know why the Rav got so upset with Rav Shlomo Gorin. When in 1969, when they landed on the moon, Rav Gorin, well, I found it even online today that there's a whole article in Yediot. Rav Gorin said that now we have to change the Nusach of Kiddush Levana. Because what do we say in Kiddush Levana? We say, "Kishem shani roked kenedecha ve'ini yachol in goch bach." Since you know I can't touch you, so all my enemies can't touch me. So Rav Gorin said, "But now we're on the moon." So he said, instead we should go back to the old girsa. The old girsa, it's mentioned in Masechta Sofrim, and it's also the Groz girsa. It says, "Kishem shani roked kenedecha." Just as I've, you know, I dance opposite you, ve'eni nogeabach, and I don't touch you. So not that I'm not able to touch you, but I don't touch you. So what does this have to do with the Rav? I mean, that was Rav Gorin's thing. Rav Gorin said that now, actually, this gives us a chance to go back to the Groz Girsa. The Rav Gorin was actually very attached to the Gra. When I was in Vilna last year, actually, since, let me show you this. I'll pull it up. When I was in Vilna, I found the following in the Vilna Shul that barely gets a minyan, and it's a bunch of tourists and old timers. Look what I found in the Vilna Shul. Hold on, let me pull it up here. I made a copy of it. Here you go. This is the Rav Gorin. He brought his book. He wrote a whole book on the Yerushalmi and the Gra. He brought it to Vilna with him, and here it's a present, a donation. Shaila Beis HaKnesses HaGadol BaVilna, Taras Rosh, Mokel Menuchaso Shel HaGra, Zatzal. He gave it in Chavtes Tammuz, 1993, in Vilna, Rav Gorin. So fortunately, I had my phone. I came for Minyan during the week, and I saw that. If I was there on Shabbos, I wouldn't have been able to take the picture. So I snapped the picture. Believe me, there's no one there learning his sefer. So I was wondering, well, you know, the Rav, it's known he got very upset with Rav Gorin. In the book Mentor of Generations, edited by Zev Elif, it's all about the Rav, on page 150 and 151, Rabbi Heshi Billet says as follows: there was a well-known rabbi who often sought headlines for himself, not the most coveted way to refer to Rav Gorin. After the moon landing, he declared that when we say Kiddush Lavana, we should no longer say about the moon V'ini Yachol in Goldbach. Rather, we should say, Eini Nogebach, I'm not touching you. This was reported in the Boston Jewish Advocate. The Rav bristled. Quote, doesn't he know that it means that when I say Kiddush Lavana on earth, I'm not able to touch the moon? In other words, the Rav said that it doesn't mean that we can't get in a rocket. It means that right now when we're saying it, I can't touch the moon. Even though the rabbi's amended text is a variant reading in Masechah Sofrim, and I would also add the Gra, the Rav resented the suggestion to change an old Jewish prayer text just for a soundbite and some publicity. This is the Minhag Gra. So I don't know why the Rav was, unless he thought it was only because of the publicity. Do we have time? Yes. So let's, before we get to Marvin Fox, let me just spend 5 minutes on what I told you last class about Rabbi Volk, because I know people are interested in that. And I want to share my screen here. Let's see. Here is Rabbi, where is he? Rabbi Volk, of Shmuel Laser Volk, great Telzer. And I told you that he has been completely erased from the YU institutional memory. Here, for instance, is a book that they published a number of years ago, all the Rosh Yeshiva. And if you look here, you have all the Rosh Yeshiva, including the ones who weren't there that long, like Rav Shimon Shkop. You go down the list. And by the way, you have here this over here, Harava Gold, Rav Zerubovel Shusain. I said, thank you, our sponsor for today's class, as one of the people pointed out to me that he was a Rav, but he was a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elkanan, Rabbi Shusain. Where he got the names of Rabovel, I don't know. I looked in my book, the names Otzer Hashemos Rabonim. It has like 25,000 rabbis. There's never been a rabbi of any stature named Zerubovel. And I don't know how he got that name. So Rabbi Volk is not mentioned at all. Furthermore, I have this book from Rabbi Kefet, Rakafot Aaron, Volume 4. And on page 308, he has a picture here of the Reitz faculty in 1944. And he identifies everyone, and he says as follows: recently, this picture has circulated without all the staff being singled out. The following is the correct identity of the faculty administration in this portrait. There is a picture, this picture of all the Rosh Yeshiva. When they get to Rav Volk, they say unidentified. So what's going on? Rabbi Kefet is very upset with this, that, you know, how can you just delete someone who was there for decades at the yeshiva? So let me tell you why they did this. Look, it's wrong because it's not historically correct, but I get it. And Rabbi Rakefet actually has a few. Thank you, Nachum Shmayahu, for sending me links to Rabbi Rakefet's long discussions of this. Rav Volk, let me show you a picture here of him again. His son, by the way, if you go to the Kvarim site about him, it has an article there. His son, Benjamin Volk, maybe the people here who were in YU with him, he was a great mathematician. He won this big award at YU for mathematics, and he gets a master's in mathematics He's not even old enough to vote. It says here he received a BA when he was 18. Okay, so you have a whole discussion of the son. So what's with the father? Well, the story is as follows. By the late 1960s, I don't know the exact year, Revolt has medical issues, and it's about 2 years, I believe, that he's not teaching. He
Okay.
had, I guess, operation, recovering. So when he's done with this, he wants to come back to Yeshivas Ritzel Hanan. The problem is he only gave shiur in Yiddish. He didn't speak English well enough. And the yeshiva told him that, sorry, that the young people, they don't know Yiddish. And if you can't do it in English, then you can't be Rosh Yeshiva. And you have your pension, your social security. It's time for, basically, they're putting him out the pasture. And Revolk refused to accept this. And he took them to New York Labor Court. I don't know why he didn't go to Beis Din, or he went to Beis Din, and they didn't, why you wouldn't go, whatever it is. He went to New York Labor Court and he lost. And after that, Revolk is a gaon, an unbelievable gaon. He has 8 volumes of Sha'arei Tohar. He was a recognized expert in Taros, but and in all different matters. And I Googled, not Googled, sorry, I searched on Otzer HaChokhmah, and people are citing him all the time. It's like the yeshiva world now has access to the sefer Otzer HaChokhmah. He's being cited a lot. And I have to say, you should always have an editor. I'm glad I have an editor because I can't just publish anything. Someone else sees it. Revolk didn't have an editor, and he said some things in the introduction of Volume 7 and Volume 8. To be frank, he said some disgusting things. And what he said about the Rav is bad enough. What he said about he savages Belkin. I'm not even going to tell you what he says about Belkin, and it's completely inappropriate. So I get why he's been totally removed. On the other hand, he's taught thousands of Talmidim, and he's part of Yeshivas Ritzel Hanan for like 25 years. But I'll just tell you what he says about the Rav because it's of interest, and then we'll get back to Marvin Fox. Incidentally, before I tell you that, the Svarim Blog last year published a piece by Avram Vilner, which has memories of Shmaya Shulman. And he discusses Revolk, what a gaon Revolk was. He was considered in Tells, the leading person in Tells, greater than the ones who became the Rosh Yeshiva. He has a story here how he went to test the Rav, did the Rav know Taros, and the Rav knew it. But it's real gaon. But in volume 7 of Sha'arei Tohar, he goes off on the Rav because obviously the Rav was close to Belkin and Belkin was the real enemy. In fact, the reason they delete Revolk is probably because of what he says about Belkin. The Rav gave a drasha. I don't know if it's ever been recorded, the whole drasha. You can hear it online while you Torah, and here you hear from the commentator excerpts of it. I think all the good stuff is here, but I don't know if it's ever been completely transcribed. And he describes Belkin as Arami Oved, the restless nomad, the wanderer, basically. In fact, I believe, does he say it here? Yes, a restless yeshiva Talmud. Does he say the restless yeshiva Bacher? I don't know if he calls him, in Yiddish, he must have used the term wandering, at least the wanderer, not restless, because Rabbi Volk, at least he says he heard in the newspaper that the Rav Soloveitchik, he calls him Hagaon HaYadua, he gave a hesped and he refers to him as the wandering yeshiva bacher. What we see in the English here is a restless yeshiva, but he says a wandering yeshiva bacher, and Rav Volk goes off on him. How doesn't Rav Soloveitchik know that this comes from the non-Jews? They say we're the wandering Jews. And it's not a positive thing, it's a negative thing. And here he's referring to Dr. Belkin as the wandering yeshiva bacher. And then he goes off saying, attacking the Rav more. And then, as I said, he's savages. That's the only way I can describe it, the way he describes Belkin. Totally inappropriate. It's embarrassing. And it's unfortunate that he wrote that. He's part of YU's history. Okay, with that. For those other things, I'll get to, God willing, next week or the week after, because we're going to finish the letters, I think, today or just about, and then we'll have time to catch up before we start the next segment of the letters with many comments people have sent me I haven't gotten to. But we're still, I gave the introduction, and now let me share with you the letter. I published these letters. You can see it in a blog post, but I just want to summarize it for you and share some other points. Because as I said, that as I mentioned, that Marvin Fox was stuck with a problem. So here's the first letter from 1955. This is a draft. As I said, I don't think he sent the Hebrew letter. I think he sent an English letter because the Rav's response is in English. But let me just read it and summarize it for you here. He's writing to the Rav about a difficult matter, kasho musubach, and he wants a psak halacha. And you see from the first paragraph that he discussed the matter with the Rav in his house. And the situation is the Orthodox community in Columbus. Notice he calls it Haredit. In the 1950s, all Orthodox Jews were called Haredim. It's only like in the late 70s, early 80s, that the word Haredi just comes to mean a certain sociological grouping. He says that things have gotten much worse since the recent death of Rabbi Greenwald. That's Leopold Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, the great author of the Kolbo Alavelos, which is the standard halachic text for issues of mourning, Avelos, as well as many historical works and halachic works. We'll see something interesting, and I'll show you some pictures of Greenwald in a few minutes. He says, with the passing of Rabbi Greenwald, that's also 55, there's no more Horah that we can rely on. There's no posek anymore in the city of Columbus. He says, my question, however, is not about that really. It's about the synagogues here in Columbus. As I explained to you, there's only one shul, which is, even though there's more than one shul that's, quote, Orthodox, only one shul that follows halacha, that has a machitza between men and women. And this shul is in an old area. People are not living in there, in that part anymore. And you can't go daven there because it's too far away. He says that there's even was a question whether you can daven in Rabbi Greenwald's shul. Now, why would there be a problem davening in the great Rabbi Kasiel Yehuda Greenwald? The Rabbi Greenwald, by the way, who was a bit of a kanai. You should see the way he attacks the modern, what he calls the modern Orthodox, and he was a bit of a kanai. But what's the story? What does he say? Why can't you daven in Rabbi Greenwald's shul? Because although the men and women don't sit mixed, in place of a machitza, there's only a rope, which he says a theater rope that separates the men and the women. And even for this compromise, the Parnassim of the community the Parnassim opposed this, but they accepted it because the rabbi said you need to. But now that Rabbi Greenwald has passed on, they're going to change this shul, it seems. And it's going to become like all other shuls. So let me tell you, and he says it's almost certain that they'll sit together now. So what's with Rabbi Greenwald's shul? Well, Rabbi Greenwald... he had a regular Orthodox shul, but as the times were changing, the community demanded that there would be mixed seating. And he said, of course not, you cannot have that. They came up with a compromise that they would separate them and there'd be a rope down the middle. Rabbi Greenwald actually, before he died, announced that this was his last year. He can't do it anymore. And originally, they wanted to have mixed seating, and he said he'd have to resign, and it's absolutely forbidden. But Greenwald compromised on this, and whether because he had no other parnassa or because he thought it was important to keep them in the fold, he had to deal with other issues. When he started at that show, he started, it was a very popular Friday evening gathering, where people would come back to show for like an oneg, divrei Torah, but then he saw that people were driving the show, and he actually canceled it. I do not believe they ever sat mixed seating. There's an article that appeared in Jewish Life that talked about how this shul, Beth Jacob, there was a Rabbi Stavsky who was a YU guy who he was able to, I don't know how many years it took him, but he was able to put in a machitza. And he doesn't mention anything about mixed seating. I'm not sure if they kept the rope or not. But here is, let me show you a picture of Rabbi Greenwald. It's a picture that appears in one of his books towards the end of his life. He authored a great deal. So that's a good picture of Rabbi Yekosiyo Yehuda Greenwald. Incidentally, for some reason, the Rav was no fan of the Kolbo Alavelos. I don't know why. That was a standard work. But let me show you another picture of over by Greenwald. Oops. Oh yes, here it is. Okay, now I can show it to you. Here's another picture of Rabbi Greenwald. This is from the early 30s, and the small young guy in the middle, Jack. Anyone from Denver would know Jack Greenwald. He passed away just last year, and that's Jack. But the other, there's really no. He had no. There's no great descendants from him and the other children. I don't know what became of them. No connection to religion, as far as I know. It's interesting. His wife, although he's Hungarian, she was a Litvisha woman without the shadol. That would be expected. But I mean, he's Hungarian. As I told you, he's a bit of a Kanai, but I assume she's American, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if she's Hungarian. I think she's American, but that's Mrs. Greenwald. And I think this is a very nice picture of Rabbi Greenwald in his younger years. I thank Rabbi Pinny Dunner for giving me this picture of Rabbi Greenwald. When I do my my book, God willing, on the whole history of America, I will have a lot to say about Rabbi Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, because he had an impact and very interesting. Okay, let's continue with the letter. So Dr. Fox says, so there's we can't daven, maybe. He's not sure what's the situation with Rabbi Greenwald Shul. And then he says, okay, and he says, now that Rabbi Greenwald's not here, we have to hope that at least they hire a good rabbi who'll keep them on the straight and narrow. Then he says, the third shul. So we have three shuls, one in the bad neighborhood or the faraway neighborhood that has a machitza. Rabbi Greenwald shul, which is iffy. And then the third shul, which is also called Orthodoxy, he says it's the largest shul and has the most daveners. And the person, the leader of it, is this person, Rabbi Rubinstein, that I explained to you, Rabbi Soloveitchik, all of his milas, in quotes. They daven, he says, to go down there, they daven, completely mixed seating. There's not even a zecher of machitza. Men and women sit one next to another, and he says they also violate other halachos in this shul. And there's no one there who can, who protests. For example, when they have bar mitzvahs, the rabbi, together with the parents, make a shechianu with Shema Malchus. The rabbi gets up, and together with the parents, they all say Shema Malchus. How can the rabbi say a shechianu? Parents also, what are they doing saying shechianu? Also, he says that they made a late Friday night service. And he says there's not a Seder, there's not tefillah there. And then they do their own thing. They're not davening at the proper time. He says they changed the matbeah shetavlo hachamim. They created their own service, basically. He says, I don't need to elaborate on this because I explained to you when I was there. So here's Marvin Fox's question. Am I permitted to daven in this shul? This is Agudas Achim. It would later become a conservative shul, by the way. Can I daven there? And then Fox, question two. If it's forbidden to daven there, I ask you, the Rav, what should I do? Is it better for me to daven be yechidus by myself and not to create a disruption in the community? Or perhaps should we create a new shul? Al pi ruach ha-Torah v'masoreth. Create a, or should we try, should I be, quiet and just stay home and daven? Or should I try to create a new shul, which obviously is going to create controversy in the community? He says, Einani b'tivi, he says, I am not an ohev machokas. I'm not one who likes controversy. But I am prepared to lifrosh min hatzibur, to separate from the community and gather together the Yehudim Charedim, that is the Orthodox Jews, Yirei Shamayim, and make a minyan that we can daven according to halacha. If you say that this is the right thing to do, and he says, maybe it's actually better for me to stay in this Agudas Achim shul and to fight against it on the inside. Even though this is not going to be pleasant, I'll do what I can. So he asked the Rav what he should do. We actually have a second letter from after the Rav's reply. Fox, I'll just read this to you since it's on the screen before we get to the Rub's reply, because we see what Fox did. This is a few, he said, he begins, "Now that I've returned to my permanent residence in Columbus," he's now, what does he mean, permanent residence? Well, because he was in Harvard for 1 year, like 56, the 55, 56, I think it was. I heard this from his son, Avi Fox, who lives in Chicago. So he was away from Columbus for the year. He was a visiting scholar at one of the institutes at Harvard. So he says that now I've come back. We organize, he says, but he says, "I was several years ago, I was able to organize a strictly Orthodox minyan. And we met regularly on Shabbos and Yom Tov. When I moved to Boston, the minyan disintegrated. Since my return," maybe it was 57, 58, he was in Boston. "Since my return, I want to establish it again." So he says, "Recognizing the completely unambiguous character of your own statements on the prohibition of praying in the synagogue mixed seating," he says, "I prayed at home by myself." In other words, Martin Fox comes back to Columbus. The Orthodox minyan that he had created had fallen apart, and in the meantime, he has nowhere to daven, so he's davening at home. He says, "Even on Rosh Hashanah, I didn't enter the local synagogue." I'm assuming Marvin Fox knew how to blow shofar, so he blew it for himself, but the Rav says, if that's the choice, you don't hear it. He says, "The only congregation in my neighborhood is led by a graduate of YU, this Rubenstein, who advertised himself as Orthodox." And he says, he reminds the Rav, it's a completely mixed seating and deviates from other accepted norms. So now Marvin Fox asks a different question. "Can I go to this shul when they're davening in the Beis Medrash and there aren't any women? That is, during the week, they would daven in the Beis Medrash of the shul, and there wouldn't be any women there. So the question is it only the sanctuary of mixed seating that I can't daven, or I can't even step into the building for, let's say, a mincha minyan where there's only men?" It's not clear from what we've seen already what the Rav's position. We saw that the Rav refused to even go into the conservative temple sanctuary for a funeral. But you could say that that's a religious service. Is the Rav saying you can never step foot into a non-Orthodox a conservative sanctuary? We have weddings in conservative synagogues where Moshe is matur. He doesn't like it, but he's matur. And in certain places, in Long Island and other places, it's quite common where there are certain conservative synagogues that you use there. There was a couple of years ago, or actually last year in my town, guy running for Congress. He gave a talk, a campaign speech, basically, at the local conservative synagogue. And it was plenty of Orthodox people went. Would the Rav have a problem with this? It's not davening. It's in the evening one night. Not to mention, we're talking about a different room entirely. There have been many examples of conservative synagogues, or mixed seating, I should say, synagogues that also had conservative, that also had mechitza minyanim in them. That became a popular thing. For many of these mixed seating shuls, the younger people didn't want to daven without a mechitza, so they created mechitza minyanim. I mentioned last week, Rabbi David Feldman of Teaneck. Well, there was a mechitza minyan began in his shul, and many shuls. If you go to Beis Medrash HaGadol in Denver, when I was there last year, so I davened in the mechitza minyan. So I never thought it was an issue, but the Rav is saying, I mean, he's asking the Rav, what does the Rav say? I mean, I even think that I can tell you that many rabbis have told people that for family simchas, they say daven ahead of time and just go sit there during the service. So I don't know what the Rav's position would be on that. So this is what Marvin Fox, he wants to know. Fox says to him, "Apart from the fact that I want to daven with a minyan, there's another reason," he says, "why I want to daven in this, the Beis Medrash minyan. Because," he says, "everyone in the city knows that I don't go to the shul. But," he says, "I'm distressed to find that most people don't understand why. They think I have machlokes, that I don't like the rabbi or some sort of quarrel." He says, "Hardly anyone understands the reason I'm not davening there. But if they would see me davening, you know, in the morning minyan, where it's a kosher minyan, then they'll know it's not personal motives." Furthermore, it says that, he says this is the largest congregation in the city with over 800 families. He says, "If I attend this Beis Medrash, I might minyan, I might have an opportunity of influencing people. We don't want to lose them to Orthodoxy." Nevertheless, he says, I want to hear what you have to say, Rabbi Soloveitchik. Unfortunately, we don't have the answer. We don't know what the Rav applied." And actually, that reminds me, I'm going to email Avi Fox. He'll remember probably. if they davened in the Beis Medrash when he was growing up during the week, we'll see. In fact, Professor Fox's wife is still alive, quite elderly. So I'll get an answer to that next time. And finally, before we get to the Rav's reply, we have one final letter. The same time that he wrote to the Rav in 955, this is a letter that you need to have backbone to write it. So Marvin Fox writes to Rabbi Rubinstein. He says, "I wanted to discuss this personally. However, I had to go to Boston." This is not the year he was in Boston, but he also traveled to Boston there. So I'm writing to you. He's saying, listen to this language. "My purpose in writing is to inform you and through you, the leaders of your congregation, that I've decided to withdraw from the Agudas Achim Synagogue and have joined with a group of like-minded people in establishing a separate minyan. Mr. E. L. Schottenstein, I don't know how they pronounce it. That's obviously the Schottensteins from the Art Scroll Talmud, has very graciously granted us the use of his home as well as his active cooperation." This is the minyan that Fox wrote about to the Rav that he established, but then when he went to Boston, for whatever reason, it fell apart. He says that we're going to have our first service this coming Shabbos. We're not competing with you. We're only motivated by one concern, the conviction that we can only daven in a minyan that's strictly Orthodox. He says, "To our great sorrow, your shul, Agudas Achim, in spite of its great and pious tradition, can no longer be considered Orthodox." Listen to this, though. Fox makes interesting confessions. "When the new building was built, I was prepared to make some allowances for deviation of halacha in the belief that this would serve to keep our people with us and us strengthen Orthodoxy." Agudas Achim only started mixed seating a few years before this, or right before this, when they opened up a new building. Fox says that I was willing to compromise. I thought that this is what the people wanted, better to keep them in our shul, and we'll have to accept mixed seating, and at least we'll keep them with all the other halachic areas that will keep them in line. I recognize now that my judgment was badly in error. Marvin Fox said that this idea that I thought that we could have a shul that doesn't have mechitza, but the rest of it will be Orthodox, and that'll keep the people. He says, "I recognize this was badly an error. Instead of," and again, Marvin Fox is a musmach when he's writing this. So it shows you how, an Orthodox musmach, mid-20th century, could see this as we saw Rabbi Gasol HaPool last class, that this is something that Orthodoxy might have to compromise. Fox says, "I recognize now that my judgment was badly in error. Instead of serving as a barrier against violations, the first compromise has only led to others. The result has been that today the pattern of Agudas Achim is indistinguishable from that of most Orthodox conservative synagogues. Those of us who are sincerely committed to the doctrine of Tamei Shemayim accept the whole structure of Halacha as binding. Under the circumstances, we have no alternative but to establish a new minyan which will be guided in all of its procedures by halachic principles exclusively." And then Fox gives a few of the other troubling areas in addition to mixed seating. He says again, there was he understands that I understand the pressures that brought about the mixed seating. There was a time, he says, when I had sympathized with the point of view of those who favored mixed seating. Not just he thought, he even sympathized. He thought that this would be a positive thing. "Today, I am convinced that my earlier attitude was very severely misstated." And he goes on to say that mixed seating in the shuls have been prohibited by every recognized Gadol b'Torah. And your own teacher, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, is among the strongest opponents. He says, you will no doubt recall his article of some months ago, which appeared in the Yiddish press. In it, he, and we read that article. I summarized that article last class, or two classes ago. In it, he issued an absolute prohibition against participation in any service in the synagogue where there is no mechitza. He says, no shul that considers itself Orthodox can have mixed seating. And then he goes on that there's other flagrant violations. He says the late service, the Friday night service, that's no good. To recite the various brachas out of order, you can't do that. He says that the practice of Agudas Achim, we saw this to have the parents of the bar mitzvah to recite Shehecheyanu together with the rabbi, that obviously is impossible. You can't do that. We have a bracha, Baruch Shepatarani, and we don't even say Hashem's name when we do that. He says that he gives another example that when they say in the morning, Micha Mocha, right after when the cantor concludes, Sur Yisrael, Micha Mocha, Sur Yisrael, Gal Yisrael, Then what happens? They announce the page numbers. Everyone knows, he says. There's no heter for the announcing of pages or any announcements. You can't, you have to be somech gula tefila. He says the practice of a special prayer for the sick. They made their own prayer. So they said the Misha Beirach, but no one paid attention to that. So the rabbi would say his own prayer. He says, why are we saying our own prayer for the sick? I mean, I don't know why he's getting so excited about this. Why can't the rabbi have his own prayer for the sick? But, and also the confirmation ceremony. He says, leaving aside whether such a ceremony is at all permissible, and also ignoring the fact that girls beyond the age of adolescence were on the bima, what cannot be ignored is the unbelievable and heartbreaking fact that in an Orthodox synagogue, the Torah was removed from the Ark on an ordinary Sunday morning with all the prayer and ceremony reserved for the officially established occasion for Torah reading in the shul. And it says, and they read a portion of the Torah. So basically, Sunday morning, they had the confirmation. You had girls on the bima. Today, I don't know if they have such a problem. Even Orthodox, they have girls for bat mitzvah. Girls get up and they give divrei Torah. But he says, but leaving that aside, he says that you took out a sefer Torah, you read from the sefer Torah in the ordinary fashion with all the prayers. I don't know if they, I guess they called up people for an aliyah. They did, you know, vayhi ben soa, the whole bit. Now, we're not allowed to read from the sefer Torah during the week. You can read it, I guess, to practice if you're preparing. But, or if you're learning Torah, but you can't read it as a ceremony. And Fox concludes, for these reasons, it's clear that no sincerely observant Jew has the right to participate in services at Rosh Hashanah. We are forming an Orthodox minyan in order to provide facilities for Jews in the Bexley area to worship in the way required by Torah and Halacha. Can you imagine a rabbi getting such a letter? How he, I mean, this is, it's basically a slap in his face. And, look, now Columbus is a center for Torah. I was there once because they have every year the baseball. Columbus is the biggest city. It's much bigger, like twice the size of Cleveland and Cincinnati, although they don't have the professional sports teams, but that's why people don't know this. But it's big. And they have the Yeshiva League high school baseball tournament every year is there. So I went there once, and it's the problem that Marvin Fox wrote about don't exist anymore, doesn't exist anymore. But so here we see the letter to the Rav, the two letters, and the letter to the rabbi. So what does the Rav reply? Well, and this is the final letter that I published in the Chakira. The Rav's letter is June 23rd. And actually, I want to see Fox's letter is June 21st. So that's of interest because so Fox wrote. I mean, he wrote already to the Rav, but before he got the letter back from the Rav, he maybe spoke to the Rav earlier on the phone, or he got Rabbi Gifter's letter, whatever it is. He didn't wait for the Rav's letter. He remember he asked, "Can I pray in this synagogue of Rubinstein?" And even before receiving the Rav's letter, he wrote to Rubinstein saying, no, I can't pray in Agudas Achim. But what does the Rav say? The Rav says, excuse my delay, the delay in answering your letter. You know, it's interesting. June 23rd, I'd have to look at the Hebrew date of the Rav's letter. Maybe he wrote him first in English and I didn't receive the Rav's letter, so he was going to write him again in Hebrew. Interesting. I'll check on the dates. So what does the Rav say? Let me just make a note here. He says, my attitude towards a synagogue with mixed seating arrangements has been explained, he says, to rabbis and lay people many times. They must be separated. Women and men must be segregated in the synagogue by a partition. Otherwise, the synagogue not only forfeits its halachic status, but becomes a secularized and vulgarized house of worship unworthy of its name. Whoever quotes me to the contrary is deliberately lying. And we saw the Rav's whole explanation. I mean, he says that the concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. He talks about how when you, during prayer, you must feel alone. He mentions in the next paragraph that the presence of women among men or men among women evokes a certain frivolity. That's the sexual thing I mentioned already. But, you know, the Rav, his novelty, his uniqueness is adding this whole piece about when man stands before God, he must be alone, regard the creator as his only friend. So that's the rub. That's not something you'll find in any other sources. Then he says, regarding your problem, I don't know the circumstances in Columbus. All I can say is that stay at home, even on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, rather than being in such a service. Organize your own minyan, he says, if you can. The issue of the synagogue today has assumed central significance, and therefore you must ascribe to the synagogue tradition almost dogmatic significance, and to the struggle for its survival, the character of a Machamas Mitzvah. So here the Rav says it, that this is our Machamas Mitzvah. This is where we're drawing a line in the sand. He says that until now, Orthodoxy has been too lenient to mix pews. Orthodox rabbinical seminaries have tacitly endorsed this semi-reform trend, and they send their graduates into conservative temples. A conspiracy of silence has been organized by many Orthodox leaders who have neither faith nor courage to fight for a sacred cause. It's high time that a few pioneers whose hearts are aching at the pitiable sight of self-betrayal and self-deception, bring the issue into the open and take a courageous stand on matters dear and sacred to us. Their voices will certainly echo throughout the Jewish community, and many will follow their lead. And that's what happened. You know, had the Rav adopted a different position, had the Rav adopted Rav Regensburg position, let's say, had the Rav been lukewarm on this and not made a big deal about it, things could have developed very differently. The Rav put a line in the sand, and he fought for Mechitza. He fought in an era when it wasn't fashionable, and things turned out the way he wanted, I think. I mean, like I said, we'd have to actually do a study to see. My sense is that more of these synagogues that were Orthodox mixed seating eventually moved to the Orthodox fold, but there definitely are some that moved to the conservative fold. So to see whether here or Regensburg was more successful, we have to actually do a statistical study. But as far as the Rav is concerned, you know, being successful is not, you know, after 30 years, if you still have synagogues that are mixed seating, that's not a success, even if you're keeping them, as it were, in the fold. For the Rav, this is a battle that has to be fought by going into the mixed seating synagogues, but it's not an eternal battle. You know, we give it a certain amount of time, and we've reached a point today where there's no really no Orthodox synagogues that have mixed seating, at least no OU synagogues. There's a few very traditional synagogues that have mixed seating, but it's basically the battle basically has been won. That Orthodoxy is identified with mixed seating and with separate seating, and mixed seating is identified with non-Orthodoxy. So much so, as I said already a few classes ago, you could be the most left-wing liberal Orthodox Jew or call yourself Orthodox, but you have to keep the mechitza. You can change everything else. You can have women reading the Torah, and you could probably even count women to a minyan, come up with some solution to be egalitarian, but you'd have to keep the mechitza, because that's really a boundary marker. So with that, we finish the letters of the Rav. Since I see we have like 5 more minutes, I just want to call your attention to one more thing. In the book Mentor of Generations, by edited by Zev Elif. These were articles that appeared over a year or two in the Commentator, the YU paper, from people, students of the Rav from the 40s up until more recent years, the 30s actually. The people weren't with the Rav in Boston and Yeshiva in the 30s. Well, the Rav really wasn't there in the 30s. Well, you have by Bernard Lander. And really, these are people not learning with the Rav in Boston, but people who knew the Rav learning with the Rav in New York, but people who knew the Rav in Boston and learned with him. The Rav had a yeshiva, Hechel Rabbeinu Chaim Alevi, in Rav Michal Feinstein. The Brisker Rav son-in-law was there at this yeshiva. So the Rav had a yeshiva there. I knew someone. His name was Fand, David Fand. He was an economist at George Mason University. He's passed away. He was in Yeshiva Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi in Boston. He's from Boston. And he told me he wasn't religious. He wasn't Orthodox when I knew him, but in his youth he was. And he studied in that. He told me that one night the Rav, so the Rav would have been this would have been like 35, 36 years old. One night he said the Rav woke them up. This is like the story, the Bub Mices you hear, but he told me this, that the Rav woke them up 2 in the morning or something, that they were all living like in this big house. And he says that he got the answer to the problem they were struggling with. So he actually, he couldn't go to sleep and he woke them up to tell them the answer to this. But in this book, on page 6, you have a story here by one of the Rav's early Talmidim, who he got the smicha reads in 44, that in the Maimonides school at the Tisha B'Av Shir that the Rav gave in Maimonides, he went there once and there were Satmar Hasidim there. And he asked them what they were doing there, and they answered the Satmar Rav himself had sent them to hear the Rav. And he said, the next morning I went to see the Satmar Rav. And he responded, what's the matter with you? Who in the whole world knows Kutshim like Rav Yoshe Ber? So I find this amazing because here we have testimony. I know it's hard to believe because as far as the Satmar Rav is concerned, at least if you read his writings, you can't listen to a Zionist. You can't hear Torah from them. They're out. Here we have someone. I assume he's a valid witness that he's not alive. Unfortunately, I can't ask him about this. He claims that the Satmar Rebbe, and he claimed he spoke to the Satmar Rebbe himself, that the Satmar Rebbe sent people to hear the Rav. Okay, if that's what he says, I'll accept it. I know someone asked if there's any connection. Also, in this book, there's a good article by Rabbi Charlap called The Rav and Dr. Belkin, Their Special Relationship, which had a break when the Rav publicly stood up in, I think it was 70, 1970, and argued against changing the charter of YU. And that created a real distance between them. But at the end, they came together and they cried later with Belkin's deathbed. They're very, very close. So now we finished the letters that I published in Chakira. This is the plan. I'll get to the comments in a second. Next class, I'm going to do with you the letter. I have one other letter. This is a halachic letter, which we're going to deal with Shabbos, laws of Shabbos. Chakira wouldn't publish it. I'll show you the letter. I'll put it on the screen, and I'll explain this letter, and we'll talk about even the Rav's mother, because the Rav's mother plays an interesting role in this as well. The Rav's mother, who was a Talmidei Chacham in her own right. And then we'll see the letter to Meir Kahana, and maybe we'll begin also next class, because I do want to do some in response to requests, and it's a good idea, before we complete it. When we finish the letters of the Rav, then we're going to go to Rav Zelman Bamberger, and then the Musar controversy. But I do want to do still some letters on the Rav that were published by Rabbi Helfgott, because that would round out the picture. And there's some themes that we didn't get to. We got to many themes, but girls studying Gemara, how a posek, we saw some of how a posek is supposed to look at matters, but the classic example we'll see, and also some interfaith stuff, which I think is also helpful. So we'll do that as well. Now let me just look at the questions, and someone privately text me there. Rav Goren raised a lot of hackles at the time when he said, changed the version of Kiddush Lavona. And he says, from Menachem El Kasher's chapter in his book on the moon landing about a different comment. Well, the different comment that Gershon is referring to is that Rav Goren thought that that the mitzvos are for the earth. And if you're not on earth, if you're in outer space, then mitzvos don't apply. I think what Rav Goren meant by that, obviously, like, you can't commit adultery in outer space, but things like Shabbos has no meaning. That was the whole question. Where do you observe Shabbos when you're in outer space? And, you know, the whole idea of Shabbos means you're, now that's, the other rabbis haven't said that. When Ramon went up to his space, unfortunately he never made it, but Rav Mordechai Eliyahu gave him a psak as to what he was supposed to do about tefillin, because sometimes the sun can, you can go up and down 10 times. But that's what Gershon's referring to. That I outed it, but it's all right. No last names. That it's Rav Kasher deals with that. He says that he hopes that the report of Rav Goren that the mitzvos are only on Earth, not in outer space, that was an incorrect report. But Rav Goren was so original; he can come up with all sorts of things. Mark says the comment about Noshe Malchus for Baruch Shepaterani It might be appropriate to note that both the Gro and Aruch HaShulchan write that it should be said with Shem Malchus. So that's interesting. I didn't know that that was the Gro's position. So I wonder if the Rav held that
I
you
came
do it with the
across that when I
bracha.
was writing out something to say my granddaughter's bas mitzvah.
I didn't even know about that. But in Fox's letter, he says that the general practice today, he says, first of all, there's no Shechianu. We have a bracha, and the general practice today is that we don't say it with a bracha. So that's a thank you for pointing it out. David says that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and Yichud Shlomo, he says the father asked if he should say the bracha with Shem Malchus, and Rav Shlomo Zalman said that I made the bracha, but that's because I'm certain that I properly raised my sons. But for you, it would be preferable to make it without. Okay, so that's an interesting. Although that's not the basis of the just of the argument over whether you say it with a bracha with Hashem's name or not. Not whether you raised them. I guess they would be whether it does Gemara mention it with a name? I don't even know. We say brachos with Hashem's name that are not mentioned in the Gemara. Hanos Elayev Koach and Hallel on Rosh Chodesh for Ashkenazim. So I don't remember if, I guess I just off the top of my head without looking at it, maybe that's the crux of the issue, whether you say it with Hashem's name because the Talmud is not explicit to say it. I will check on that too. Next comment, Rabbi Yellin, the rabbi of Yeshua, Rabbi Jonathan Rosenberg, grew up and was rabbi of Avos Sholem in Columbus. He's a Musmach of Bnei Yisrael. Okay, so the shuls we were speaking about though were different ones. Maybe Avos Sholem is the one on the other side of town. I don't know what shul that is. Avos Achim is the one that was the mixed seating shul Fox was writing about. That became conservative. Beth Jacob was the one that now that then was Rabbi Greenwald's shul, who now has the mechitza. I don't know the other shuls
Yeah,
in
I'm going to
Yeshua,
ask
but
him
we've
about
had
that,
people.
and
Yeah,
I'm going
ask
to
them
ask him
what shul that was.
if he also is aware of all this that you've talked about. He has talked about Rabbi Stavsky's shul because he grew up when Rabbi Stavsky was there, Beth Jacob, and it was clearly very, entirely Orthodox at the time.
Yeah, so you can ask him. In fact, I will show you here. Let me show you something. I believe I have it on my screen here. Yes, in Jewish life, in what year was this? 1970. Oh, here it is. 74. The rabbi of an article appeared, a mechitza for Columbus. Once a mechitza has been removed, can never be reinstated. This is the whole story of the Beth Jacob Shul, Rabbi Greenwald, how the mechitza went down, and then they brought it up. So you can read, and
Absolutely. Yeah.
I can send this
Thank you.
if anyone is
Yeah.
interested. I don't know that other shul that you mentioned, though.
Yeah.
Marty
Okay.
says, I've been in West Palm Beach. To visit to my in-laws. There's a Century Village in West Palm Beach near my in-laws' home. There's an Orthodox shul right outside Century Village's entrance. Well, there's the Century Village is, I didn't know that. I know there's Deerfield and Boca. But okay, Rabbi
Definitely.
Jackson Cohen, who was actually as a young rabbi, the rabbi of the shul in West Orange, Abba Zachi Minei Jacob and David. Then he's not a YU guy. I think he's Chaim Berlin, a real Talmud Chacham. Then he goes off to Australia, or then in Australia for a while. Then he was in California, or maybe California and Australia, and then he
He
ended
was
up in West Palm Beach. So he wrote a book.
first in California and then went to Australia.
In Australia, so that he wrote a book, and then he has there his proposal for the Shabbos bus, I guess, lack of a better term. And he also has Rabbi Tengler's letter there opposing it. But he's not a nobody. I mean, he used to write a column in the Jewish press each week. So he runs a real London. Hadassah says, thank you for telling me. Reza Grun was born in Hungary in Taoiseach, Romania, married in 1913 in Romania. Thank you for telling me that. I have no knowledge of that. But clearly, I know she was quite modern. I heard this from Professor Fox's widow, that she was modern. Maybe the picture was from the 20s, even. Thank you. And Hadassah, if you can send me this information, I'd love to know it. There's someone who's writing a doctoral dissertation on Rabbi Greenwald. That's the plan. And I've sent him all a number of letters I found. I even have a letter, which I haven't sent him yet because I just found it, in which Rabbi Greenwald explained why he felt he had to leave Szeged. That's where he was. because he wrote an article and the Hasidim took offense at it, the way he described the Hasidim, and he felt that there was too much opposition, so he felt he had to leave. At least that's what he says in the letter. Someone asks, are there people who don't say the shame for candlelight in God's name, Shabbos candles, because it's post-Talmudic? We spoke about this bracha, that really it seems to be in opposition. It's from the Gaonic period, in opposition to the Karaites. As far as I know, everyone says Hashem's name in it, as far as I know.
Right, I meant it, like, rhetorically, like, in terms of the discussion of Rosh Hashanah, you were suggesting that maybe, but the reason why is because it's late. That doesn't seem to...
You're right. Why the Sfaradim, who are more machmir, for example, Rav Avadia says that women can't say Shasani Kirtzano with a bracha. In his Siddur, he says they should say Brach Shasani Kirtzano, not with Hashem's name. And he says, and that's also why Rosh Sfaradim, Rosh Chodesh, the Halo, they won't. But yet they also, they say the bracha with Hashem's name, the Sfaradim. So I don't know. It's an excellent question. If anyone knows, email it to me. So David says the bracha is not in the Gemara, but it's in the Midrash. And Mel says, I guess we can end with this, that the most recent episode of the podcast of Jewish Ideas is a discussion with Mark Shapiro. So yes, there's a new Torah Motion podcast, although they're putting all my old classes. Some of you, including David, are with us. This is taking us back like almost 15 years, my early classes on Torah Motion. They're putting them online. The sound is not the best. It's not, but it's good stuff and people are listening, but they're going slowly. So hopefully they'll speed up putting my old podcast. But what they have now, they have a great host, J.J. Kimchi, the son of Rabbi Alan Kimchi, formerly of Neri Yisrael in London, now of Israel. But if you haven't been to that show, I assume it's still a great – well, I know it's still a great show because Rabbi Zobin has taken over. And it's an American-style show. It was founded – one of the founders was Shatzkus, the son of Rav Aaron Shatzkus, the Y.U. Rosh Hashiva, the grandson of Rav Moshe Shatzkus. When I was there once, they flew me in to speak. And he said to me, I said, this is just like an American show. And he said, yes, because when I came to London, there was no show, American-style show. So I said, well, I'll build my own show. And he built it, and obviously with a lot of English people. And if you know what an American-style show is, you know what I'm talking about, where the show is the center of communal and social life. And it's a great, great show, a lot of Torah, wonderful people there. And in that show, the rabbi for many, many years was Rabbi Kimchi, a student of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, his son, the brilliant J.J. Kimchi. If you haven't heard him, I highly recommend listening to one of the podcasts. He's a great interviewer, and he's going to have great scholarship as well. This idea of an American show, it's also an issue in Israel. If you look in the latest Mizrahi magazine, which I saw it on Shabbos, Rabbi Rothwax from Teaneck, he's going to Israel, and he says, you know, we're going to build an American show. It's tough for Americans when they go to Israel. Those Americans who are listening to us right now from Israel, you know that the show is not the same thing in Israel as it is in America. But ironically, the show in America is very much like the show in Europe, the traditional show. It's in Israel that the show has became a place you just go and daven and leave. But in Europe, the show also was a place like a center of Jewish life. I guess if the whole country is Jewish, the show is not, you know, the show is not like a refuge from the Goyish world. You go to the show, you don't need that. But still, if you grew up, if you're Israeli and you never had this, you don't miss it. But if your model is an American style show, where it isn't just a place to daven, it's a place where all social and cultural, it's a second home, basically. It's very hard not having that, and therefore there's a Rabbi Rothwack says he's going to build an American shul. There are American shuls there. When I was in Renana, I mean, the shul I dove in, there are a few shuls. There's the South African shul, and there's the Ohari. These are like American-style shuls, so don't think that Americans don't have good things to bring to Israel. We can bring a lot of good things also. It's a kibbutz galiot. Every galus will bring something good, and I think when I was in Israel, my year in Israel, Rabbi Berzon didn't say that. Rabbi Berzon was in Rabbein. I still remember. He said that the best thing, he's saying, of course, they will try to indoctrinate us all to go on Aliyah. He says, we need you here in Israel. Why do they need us here in Israel? Now you might say, because free market ideas, American-style shows. Well, no, Rabbi Berzon said, because us Americans will teach Israelis what does it mean to be polite. He says, if you go into the bank now, there's no line. Everyone's pushing in. He says, we can show what it means to have order, polite. That's not so much American. They had it in Germany also. So Rabbi Berzon said, that's why we need American Olim, because that's what we're going to bring. I'd like to think that we could bring a little more than that. But anyone who wants me to send anything, please send me emails. And finally, Jacob says, there are some people who don't say the bracha on Tevilas Kelim because it's not in the Gemara. But I want to know about the bracha on the Shabbos candles. Okay, thank you. Oh, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. He's Pastor Shapiro.
Yes.
A moment. I was in Rabbi Volk's share, and what it called, I think your description of the litigation is not accurate.
Well, that's, I'm just saying what Rabbi Rakefet says, and also what I'm saying, I found it subsequently that my description of it is also, which is exact same as Rabbi Rakefet, is found here on the, if you don't know this site, it's a great site, kvarim.com. Not only do you learn where all the kvarim are, all the big rabbis, they have biographies often, and they have comments, family members, everyone's writing in. And here in the comments, it says exactly what Rabbi Rakefet said. Rabbi Rakefet said it also, I mean, that it says he couldn't make the switch, you know, to teach in English. He eventually took a leave of absence. When he tried returning to the yeshiva, they wouldn't take him back, claiming there were no students for Shir and Yiddish. He took the yeshiva before the New York State Labor Board, but lost the case. He retired to Florida and wrote two more volumes of his Sfarim, Tresh and the Yeshiva Nakdama. As a result, the yeshiva decided he doesn't exist and erased his name from all official pictures and documents. A sad story indeed. And by the way, Y.D. Miller underneath. This is Rabbi Stern, whoever that is. Y.D. Miller underneath. This is my article in the Sfarim blog from 2009 when I first wrote about it. But if you know differently.
No, I'm going to tell you and I'll send it to you. It didn't sue the labor court. He sued the Supreme Court of the state of New York. It went up to the appellate division for the highest court in the state. It's a completely different description of what either right. You got it from Rakefet or Rakefet got it wrong. Because I know Rakefet is my classmate when I was at Yeshiva College at the same time. He's a good friend of mine. But I have the official reports and what it called. And they destroy Rav Volk. The judges destroy Rav Volk. They are not what it called sympathetic to Rav Volk's position. And nothing to do with the fact. And that's why he's at university, because he kept going after them and going after them, going after them. So they called him a veteran pro se litigant. That was the name the official New York courts gave. They weren't labor courts. This is the state Supreme Court.
Okay, well, send it to me. I'm just repeating. In fact, when I first wrote about this, I knew nothing about the court case. I just knew from the Sfarim. Okay, and so one of the Sfarim in volume 6. In volume 6, Rabbi Volk, he describes a third person. He says, what would you say about a yeshiva who has a Rebbe? And then, you know, he gives the case, but he doesn't say it's about him. So again, I have no knowledge of this other than what I heard from Rakefet and what's on that site, who got it from Rakefet. So send it to me and we'll correct the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Always want to correct the record.
Thank you. And thank you, Mel, for mentioning again the new Tim podcast. As you mentioned, every couple of weeks we're releasing, and I think they are very, very interesting, a little different, and interviews. And right, the interview with Mark was just, Dr. Spear was just released. So please take a look on your podcast, channel. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Always fascinating. Tomorrow morning, of course, Dr. Sokolow and Rabbi Shulman. Wednesday, Dr. Mark Herman begins a new series on the Gaonim, four-part series in the Gaonim, sort of the unknown part of Jewish history, the link between the Amoraim of the Talmud and the Rishonim. He has recently moved to Toronto, actually. He's now a professor at York University. So that's beginning Wednesday at 1 p.m. And then Thursday at 2:15 after Marty Lakshin's class, Malcolm Simkowitz will be giving a class this week. So we'll send out information on that, and we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend, and everybody have a nice week, a nice day, and all good things. And okay, Laila Tov, everybody. And Boker Tov, David. And Laila Tov to everybody else. Okay.
Toda Rabah, Laila Tov.
Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Be well.